This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. A little bit later in the hour, how data and technology are transforming how employers measure your success. But first, some news headlines. Viagra has been on the market and available to men for nearly two decades. And this week, the Food and Drug Administration approved Addy, the first drug for women targeted at enhancing sexual drive. Is the little pink pill a win for women's sexual health, or is it just Big Pharma pushing another blockbuster product? Here to talk about that and other selected short subjects in science is Virginia Hughes, senior editor at BuzzFeed News. She's here in our New York studios. Welcome to Science. Welcome back, Jane. Science Friday.
Thanks, Ira.
Tell us about this new miracle pill from women.
Yeah, it's generating quite a bit of controversy this week and also excitement. The company that makes it was just sold yesterday, I think, or the day before, for $1 billion after the after the approval.
If this is a blockbuster, that'll be cheap, won't it?
I mean, clearly they're expecting a lot of sales of this. So it's also controversial because it's been in this FDA approval process for 5 years, and it was rejected twice before. First for efficacy, so it just didn't work very well, and the second time for side effects. So it turns out in some women, it causes low blood pressure and fainting, and these side effects can be worse if you're drinking alcohol, which, considering what the drug is for, might not be that unusual.
Especially the fainting part.
Yeah, so it's definitely a very controversial pill. Mm. I think what's really fascinating about it is that its manufacturer, this small company called Sprout Pharmaceuticals, partnered and partially funded an advocacy group called Even the Score. And for the last year, year and a half, Even Score has been putting out all kinds of campaigns to align the pill with like a pro-feminism movement. So Even the Score, the name Even the Score, comes from this idea that there are tons of drugs that have been approved for male sexual dysfunction, and there's been zero for women. And so we want to even the score by getting this drug approved. And the leadership of the company has been, you know, parroting this message too. So they've, you know, aligned with women's groups. And
well, we'll just have to see, right? We have to crowdsource the drug and see if it works.
Yeah. Well, yeah.
Yeah. Next up, a study came out. This was kind of sort of sad. It looked at the use of e-cigarettes in kids.
Yeah. So this study looked at ninth graders who showed that ninth graders who use e-cigarettes were much more likely to smoke cigarettes by 10th grade than their peers who hadn't. So, you know, it's an observational study, and it's pretty preliminary. It's not saying that this definitely proves that e-cigarettes, you know, are a gateway drug to regular smoking. Mm-hmm. But it is suggestive of that, and the question of whether e-cigarettes are good or bad for health has been this huge debate in the public health community, because some people say if you're a smoker and you switch to e-cigarettes, that's such a win because they don't have tobacco in them, so they don't have the carcinogens of tobacco going into your lungs. But if this study pans out, it could mean that they're actually, you know, encouraging.
Well, you get to be a drug addict. I mean, nicotine is one of the most highly, you know, addictive drugs. That we know.
Yeah, and right now the e-cigarette industry is not at all regulated, so kids can go into these vape shops and buy whatever products they want. You know, but that said, caffeine is an addictive drug too, and we don't, you know, kids can drink that if they want to. So the FDA, though, is planning on releasing its first regulations on e-cigarettes by the end of the year, and they will most likely be regulated as tobacco is, so probably restricted so that minors can't buy them and will have to go through an approval process.
Mm-hmm. Google released a new tool called Project Sunroof.
Yeah, so this is neat. It's so for folks who are considering or may have once considered putting solar panels on their house, it's a big investment, right? I think it's like $20,000 to put solar panels on your roof. So, and it's kind of a question of whether it makes economic sense. If it depends on like the sun exposure that your neighborhood gets, and also like whether other buildings would put shade on your roof, and it's kind of a complicated thing. But Google Maps has made this little app that will calculate this all for you, and it'll look at weather patterns in your neighborhood and even like the shade that will hit your roof and calculate for you the cost savings that would be likely for you and whether you should take the plunge.
Well, Google Earth already can see your roof.
Yeah. Yeah, so this is data they're already collecting, believe it or not. Big Google.
just making it more bureaucratic by saying fill out these, you know, this little form and say, we know what your roof looks like. And get that planter moved over.
Or you could say they're helping you save the environment.
Mm-hmm. And it's available everywhere?
No, it's available in San Francisco, Boston, and Fresno, but they'll probably be rolling it out.
Yeah. And there was a really quirky story about, I saw this today online, a vomit machine.
That's right.
If you can't vomit yourself, we'll make a machine.
Yeah. So this was a group of scientists at North Carolina State University who wanted to see exactly how vomiting would help spread disease. So how viral particles inside of vomit might stick around in the air or not, or land with the vomit on a surface. So the machine, if you saw it, you saw it's this weird clay model of a human head at one quarter the size of a real human head, and it has an open mouth, and it's hooked up to this pressure system that spews vanilla pudding that simulates, I guess, the exact viscosity of vomit.
Mm-hmm.
And so scientists can put virus into this pudding, and it spews into a plexiglass box, which can then calculate how many of the viral particles stay in the air.
Are there enough in the air?
There are. Yeah. There aren't. It's a very small fraction of the total that stays in the vomit, but you don't need very much to get infected. So it turns out that this norovirus can indeed spread by vomit.
Yeah. Well, something you could build at home if you'd like to, I guess. Thank you, Virginia. Virginia Hughes, science editor at BuzzFeed News. Now it's time to play Good Thing, Bad Thing. And we're ready to play Good Thing, Bad Thing because, you know, every story has a flip side. Scientists have identified nearly 2,000 exoplanets, from Saturn-sized gas giants that have two sunrises, sunsets every day, to Earth-like planets that might be just right for life. And they can really stretch the imagination, but except for the names of these exoplanets, hardly imaginative. Anyone recall B1620-26b? No, put your hands down. People have always wanted a chance to name the planets, but the International Astronomical Union has always reserved that privilege for itself. But now it's relaxing its grip just a bit by opening the naming process up to the crowd. The Name Exo Worlds contest is allowing the public to nominate and vote on the name of 15 stars and 32 exoplanets. So maybe the planet Vulcan, a fan favorite, might have a chance. So what could go wrong? Here to talk about good and bad of crowdsourcing planetary names is Lee Billings, space and physics editor at Scientific American here in New York. Hi, Lee.
Great to be here as always.
The good news.
So the good news, obviously, is that people are getting involved, and that's good because planets, as you said, have had really kind of ridiculous names for a long time. A few of my favorites I'm going to read to 2-mass J04414489+230153b. As one. Another one is MOA 2007 BLG 192LB.
It's more like a credit card number.
Yeah, right? These are ridiculous names. And so planets deserve names. Planets are the pathway that the universe has to make names. Planets make the namers of names, living things, right? And so planets without names are kind of sad. So it's good that people are getting involved and they're beginning to debate what names mean for planets. And all that's wonderful.
Mm-hmm. And the bad news?
Well, the bad news is that, first of all, some of these names that are being submitted and voted on are kind of glib, right? For instance, Paul Kallas, an astronomer who discovered or co-discovered a planet called Fomalhaut B, which is one of the first ones we've actually seen. We've seen it orbiting this nearby star Fomalhaut. He submitted that this planet should be called Phantasos. That's a Greek god of dreams, both in reference to his own heritage and also to the idea that a lot of people thought that this planet was illusory for a long time, essentially a figment, a dream of Kallas's imagination. Well, Phantasos is not a name you can vote for this planet.
It's not.
You can call it Planet Ninja or Planet Leisurely Fish, if you want to, but not Fantasso. So that's a thing.
I heard Edamame is a choice.
And that's another thing, is that the ballot boxes have kind of gotten stuffed a little bit because Japanese astronomy clubs have been over the moon, so to speak, for this contest. And so they've submitted name after name after name for system after system after system. And so essentially, there's going to be planets, if it goes through, there will be planets that are named after all varieties of soybeans from Japan, after Japanese desserts, Japanese professional wrestlers. There will be endless sakuras and kaguras and amaterasus and things. And so it's you could say it's a clash of countries potentially, where maybe the U.S. should stand up and care about these planets.
Maybe those Trekkies, is the voting open to any name or have they limited? Can the Trekkies stuff the ballot box with Vulcan now if they wanted to?
Unfortunately, it's a semi-private and public process for finding these names. So they consulted all these clubs and private institutions to get a pool of names that then the public can vote on. So unfortunately, the writing's already on the wall. It looks like we're going to have a lot of soybean-named exoplanets pretty soon. And you know, the real problem here is that, of course, we don't know anything about these worlds we're naming. So we could call something, for instance, Venus, thinking it's going to be a lovely planet like the goddess of love, and instead it's this hellish world right next door. We could be making that mistake all over the place, all over the galaxy.
Mm-hmm. So how can we get in on it? How does the voting take place?
Well, if you go online, I'm not quite sure how they've avoided how they're dealing with all the issues around ballot box stuffing and stuff for votes. But essentially, if you go online and just Google name Exo Worlds or go to the IAU website, you can vote there. And as long as you have an internet connection and a computer, you can vote.
Mm-hmm. Are you voting? Are you going to get in? Do you have a name?
I have voted. The only name I'm really voting on is Hubris. For a pulsar that has a planet.
Yeah, because that's what everybody who's voting has a little bit of.
Exactly.
Isn't it? All right. Well, good way to end. Thank you, Lee. Lee Billings is the space and physics editor at Scientific American here in New York. We're going to take a break. And after the break, what happens when tracking technology targets truckers, retail clerks, UPS drivers, keeps track of where everybody is going, what they're doing, and why hedge fund managers are measuring their biometrics. Tough day on Wall Street about that. We'll tell you why after the break. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. Our long-form story this week, if you, like we at Science Friday, read the New York Times and read that Times investigation this week about Amazon and how it uses data and tech tools to rank employees, measure their efficiency, gamify the workplace, you might have wondered, is this the future? Is this the new normal? Well, we did, and looking into it, we discovered that this idea of using data to track employee progress, rank performance, it's nothing new. It goes way back. But in the last 5 to 10 years, as data mining and mobile technology have gotten cheaper and more sophisticated, these tech metrics have invaded all kinds of industries, from McDonald's to truck driving, from fashion retail to the office cubicle. For example, some authors might soon be paid not by the book, but only by the pages that you actually read when you download it on Amazon. Or how about the employee who has sued her boss for firing her after she uninstalled a smartphone tracking app that tailed her not only on the job, but everywhere she went? Is this the future of work? Can all of this technology measure us fairly without being invasive while preserving our humanity? Or does it reduce us to a bunch of data points? Can it, as one of my guests writes, count the uncountable aspect of our work? What do you think? Our number is 844-724-8255, 844-SciTalk. Maybe you work in an office like this and you'd like to talk about it. Maybe you've been affected by this. Let me introduce my guests. Esther Kaplan is an editor at the Investigative Fund, a nonprofit reporting workshop in New York. Welcome to Science Friday.
Thanks. So glad to be here.
You're welcome. Karen Levy is a fellow at the Data and Society Research Institute here in New York, and she joins us here in our New York studios. Welcome.
Hi, happy to join.
Esther, let's start with you. How far back does this sort of stuff, electronic monitoring metrics in the workplace, really go?
Well, this is a subject I reported on for Harper's Magazine a few months back. And I mean, of course, tracking worker productivity goes all the way back to Taylorism 100 years ago. But electronic monitoring is relatively new. It began with call centers in the 1990s, and maybe in the early 2000s, we started seeing employers monitor the email and web use of their employees. And it's only been in the last maybe 8 or so years that we're starting to see telematics, which is the monitoring of objects like trucks, no longer requiring human inputting of data, but objects themselves reporting into a big database. And these huge data-driven scheduling systems come into play, as I said, 7 or 8 years ago. And it's only in the last 3 to 5 years, really, that we're seeing the kinds of things that we saw in that Amazon article in the Times, which is the monitoring arriving in, as you said, in the cubicle, white-collar knowledge workers, not just data entry clerks, but people who are doing very high-level tasks.
Because we have, we have stuff that didn't exist many years ago, the GPS system, the RFID devices, stuff that's stuck up, could even be in your skin and can't take it out.
And incredibly cheap data storage, right? So you now have the capacity to collect more or less an unlimited amount of data about your workers. And this is, of course, part of the challenge. Part of it, what interested me is what is it like as a worker to experience being monitored in this minute way. But for managers also, they've now got a giant tsunami of data coming at them every day. Do they even know what to do with it?
Karen, let's talk about some of the workers. I know you spent several years studying how tracking and metrics are changing the lives of truck drivers. You wrote it for Pacific Standard, a terrific new series, The Future of Work and Workers. Tell us what you found there.
Yeah, so I spent my dissertation research, actually, I spent about 3 years talking to long-haul truck drivers and other people who worked in long-haul trucking, managers, insurance companies, all kinds of different people, to try and get a sense for how the life of the trucker has changed in response to these technologies. Truckers have historically been, like, really independent workers, right? Like, they went out on the road by themselves, you know, they would communicate with each other via CB radio, but besides that, you know, nobody was really telling them what to do. They just had to get from A to B on pretty much their own terms. And the types of technologies that Esther's referring to have just completely upended what the trucking workplace looks like, right? Because, you know, truckers are certainly subject to the same you know, capitalist forces as any other industry. And it really has become a race to the bottom in terms of trying to optimize, you know, their fuel efficiency, how fast they can get things from one place to another. We've all come to really expect, you know, that we're going to get our goods really quickly.
So what changed in their lives? What did they have to do that they didn't do before?
So what's happened to them is that, you know, a lot of things get counted in trucking. So like I alluded to, right, because like fuel efficiency is really key. A lot of truckers have their fuel consumption tracked by their employers. The big thing that I was looking at is the number of miles that truckers drive. So truckers, by and large, get paid by the number of miles that they drive, and their employers track that. But what the systems don't track is things that drivers don't get paid for. So what has happened is that drivers have started to internalize a lot of risks and costs that they didn't have to before. So things like the risks of, you know, bad weather, of congested traffic, you know, all kinds of unpredictable delays on the road. And then other things that we really want them to do, right? So we really want them to inspect their trucks. They're required to do that for safety reasons. You know, a lot of truckers weren't doing that because they weren't paid for that time, and those things didn't get measured. So what happens is that workers, you know, get incentivized to either cut corners or they end up taking on a lot of these burdens for themselves.
Esther, a few months ago, you wrote in Harper's Magazine that you weren't getting your UPS deliveries, just the notices, you know, they stick them on the door, and then they weren't even ringing the doorbell. And you did some digging into this and found out why.
Yeah, well, echoing those comments, yes, the pressures on delivery drivers, I think, parallel what we've seen in long-haul trucking as well. A UPS worker, it turns out, now is monitored both by that handheld delivery information acquisition device, the Dyad in their hand, as well as 200 sensors on each delivery truck. And they get as many as 40 pages of data produced about each shift that they do. And if they are seen to have been spent too much time at a stop, too much time at a delivery, have had the back of their truck open too much, they will get called in. Discipline around this data is now routine.
So they have to maximize how fast they can move without delivering the packages then?
Well, the dyad is going to tell UPS what time, exactly where they are geolocated when they scan the package, when they pull it out of the truck, and exactly where they're geolocated when they report that it's delivered or not delivered. So they have to at least get pretty near the address that they're supposed to deliver. But if they're really pressed for time and they're behind on their metrics, one possible shortcut would be slap the slip on the door and just sprint back to the truck. Because if someone's home, that could be an extra 3 minutes, right? You wait for them to come down the stairs, they sign, it's a whole long interaction. So if you're getting way behind schedule, that's one way to have your GPS signal show that you attempted the delivery without actually chewing up those minutes, getting it into the person's hand.
I have a truck driver on the phone, Kyle from Flagstaff. Hi, Kyle. Welcome to Science Friday.
Hi, Ira. Thanks for taking my call.
Go ahead. Tell us your story.
Well, I'm 26 years old. I've been driving for 2 years, and I grew up being basically around data and being tracked by computers, and I couldn't imagine doing this job without all of this data. It's really valuable, and one of the biggest things that I have in favor of this is the fact that because my speed is tracked, and as your guest is saying about the inspections are recorded, when it comes to law enforcement, I have a trail of data that backs me up that shows that I'm doing my job properly. So in that regard, it's a positive thing.
Do you find the pressures to have to make shortcuts and do things more quickly than you would like to?
Actually, it's the opposite. Because everything is tracked. I'm not sure if you're aware of it, but there's a certain amount of hours you can drive in a day, 11 hours in a 14-hour working period. And I'm on an electronic logbook that is constantly updated, and it lets me know when I have 2 hours, 1 hour. And if I go 5 minutes over, if I can't find a place to park, the safety department is right on the phone asking me, you know, hey, you need to stop and whatnot. So I feel like in the end, it kind of protects me from having to cut corners and do things illegally or the things that are unsafe.
Mm-hmm. All right. Thanks for that perspective.
I mean, I would just say that I think there are truckers who appreciate this, and there are truckers that have difficulty with it, because when we're talking about long haul, because you can only do that 11-hour of driving within the window, as the caller said, some truckers who, before that regulation came into play, might have pulled over for a nap when they were exhausted, might not do that now because they know they'd be chewing into their 11 hours of time. I think with a lot of these, there's a downside with the UPS drivers. Once they found out that their seatbelt use was being monitored, some of them started just permanently buckling them on their seat and not using them at all because, again, it was chewing up time to unbuckle and rebuckle, and they were getting pulled in if they were over their time quotas.
Yeah. I would
just like to add that, you know, no technology is good or bad. No technology has the same effect on everybody, right? Like, a lot of it depends on the context in which it gets deployed. And so it's great that, you know, Kyle, the trucker who called in, has had a good experience with it. And in some ways, data can really protect you from, you know, some things that he was talking about, right? But I've also encountered lots of trucking companies who have encouraged their employees, you know, maybe to log in as a second user so that they reset their time, or, you know, to find ways to kind of circumvent the technology too. So it just depends, I think, on
that
context.
How does the Teamsters Union feel about this? The unionized truckers, are they involved?
The trucking labor interests have been involved. They're not nearly as powerful as they used to be, right? Because, you know, trucking deregulated about 35 years ago, and since then the role of labor has been diminished. But they have had some pretty significant wins in the regulatory sphere lately, you know, trying to make sure that drivers, don't get harassed by their employers based on these data, things like that.
I want to bring on another guest to talk about how wearable technology that measures your location, who you talk to, how you're feeling, is being used in the workplace and whether it really works like it's supposed to. Andre Spicer is professor of organizational behavior at the Cass Business School at City University in London. Welcome to Science Friday.
Hello there.
Hi. You had a an article in the Harvard Business Review about wearables where what are some of the more extreme examples of wearable tracking technologies in the workplace?
Sure. So this year we published a book called The Wellness Syndrome with my colleague Carl Cederstrom. And in this we were looking at how our obsession with wellness has started to kick back and sometimes make us less happy and healthy. And big part of this was the rise of wearables in the workplace. So we found some workplaces, like IKEA, gave people this as a Christmas gift, voluntary gift. Some companies, like BP in the US, gave it to their employees, and then they got a discount on their health insurance. But some of the companies started to make this compulsory. So one London hedge fund required its traders to wear these wearable devices, which would track how long they sleep, what they eat, how much they drink, etc., and then would correlate that with their trading patterns to track what they called biorisk. There was another case which I've just come across. I think it's Bank of America have been experimenting with tracking hormone levels of their traders. So they track their cortisol and their testosterone levels. So the idea is that if their testosterone and cortisol goes up too much, then they're more likely to make risky trades. So it's beginning to get not just under your skin, but down to your very hormone levels and to your day-to-day practices in life.
There's also sort of a technology called the Pavlok. What is that?
Yeah. So one of the most fascinating cases we came across is a technology called Pavlok. So basically, it's a nod towards Pavlov, you know, Pavlov's dogs, behaviorism. There's been a resurgence of behaviorism in recent years. And Pavlok basically works by you say, okay, I need to not check my emails at work, for instance, or I need to go to the gym or something. And you program this thing in. And then if you show that behavior, you start checking, say, the internet, surfing Facebook at work, it'll give you a warning. And then if you don't do it, you keep on checking your Facebook or whatever, then it will send out an electric shock. So it's almost like the Milgram experiments where, you know, you used to kind of the experimenter would shock you. Now you're doing that to yourself. You're kind of electrocuting yourself.
This is Science Friday from PRI, Public Radio International. We're talking about tracking in the workplace. Karen, let's talk about another phenomenon borne out by big data in the workplace, just-in-time scheduling. What is that?
Yeah, so, you know, when you're scheduling, this is something that's pretty widespread in retail and food service, those types of industries. And it used to be that when companies would schedule workers, they would kind of bear the risk of overstaffing or of slow sales, right? And that was just a cost of doing business. So you put three employees on in the morning and, you know, that was more or less, you know, about what you had for that shift. Now, a lot of these companies are using algorithms and new types of software to schedule labor using lots of predictive factors and real-time information about sales, about things like weather, special events, that kind of thing. And that sounds great, right? It sounds like it's just a way to sort of optimize labor and make your processes more efficient. The problem is that those algorithms can really wreak havoc on workers' lives by setting just really unpredictable and unlivable schedules. So, for instance, giving workers like less than a day's notice before they have to come into work, giving them really big fluctuations in the number of hours per week that they work, things like that. Actually, there have been some lawsuits about some McDonald's workers who were ordered to come to work but not to clock in until the algorithm said, you know, the sales were high enough for them to do that. So, you know, all of those practices make it really difficult for workers to get childcare, to hold down other jobs, to go to school, that sort of thing.
Let me get a quick call. I'm from Jack in Birmingham, Alabama. Hi, Jack. Can you quickly tell us what's on your mind?
Yes. I have a boss that I work in a retail establishment. This boss, when we started work, asked that we add her as a friend on Facebook. That was fine and well until she started making inappropriate comments to friends about doing business with her. And it got to the point where it got to be really intrusive. So I unfriended her. Then she sent a memo out to everyone saying she wanted to make all of us administrators on her retail Facebook page and needed our passwords. And we were to give them to her, and we did give them to her.
Wow.
I got a phone call from a friend late one night and said, hey, listen, your boss just sent me a private message. She's going through your friends list and sending messages saying, you know, you need to come. We're having a sale
right,
this week.
Jack,
you need to come shop at our store.
Jack, I got to. We're going to take a. I have to take a break. I'm Ira Flatow. This is Science Friday from PRI. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. We're talking this hour about using technology and data to measure employees in the workplace with my guest, Esther Kaplan, editor at the Investigative Fund. Karen Levy is a fellow at the Data and Society Research Institute. Andre Spicer, professor of organizational behavior at the Cass Business School in London. Our number 844-724-8255. And Karen, you know, I know that I'm listening. I'm hearing that everybody wants to keep track of everything 24/7. But how do we expect technology to know when we're brainstorming or we're staring out of the window just thinking? Or as you write, it's the uncountable that counts. What do you mean by that?
Yeah, I think that's right. I think, you know, there's this ethos that the way that we know things now is to measure them, right, is to track them and count them. And then we can optimize once we know, you know, how many of something we have. But you're right, a lot of work is really not quantifiable. Or, you know, if we choose not to count it, then what happens is that the burden of that work ends up being borne, you know, often by workers, by the people who are the least able to bear it. And I think kind of one of the issues that underlies this is that, you know, there's a tendency to want to consider labor as just like another input into the machine. But people are different, right? Labor is different. And there are a lot of externalities, you know, from public safety, if you have a tired trucker on the road, to, you know, not being able to get childcare for your children if you're, you know, you work at a Starbucks that uses just-in-time scheduling. You know, all of that stuff doesn't get factored in so much to algorithmic decision-making.
Mm-hmm. Andre, you've actually compared the system of management and self-criticism at Amazon headquarters to the Cultural Revolution in China. Can you explain that a bit?
Yeah, so the fascinating thing with the Amazon system is it involves both what we call peer criticism. So your peers can log on and talk about your failings on a kind of a web platform, but also a huge amount of self-criticism. Now, if you go and look at what happened during the Cultural Revolution in China, a major part of that was basically the same kind of thing, peer criticism and self-criticism. So you had to talk about how you weren't living up to the kind of communist ideals. The other thing which is fascinating is that Amazon have adopted what's commonly called a rank and yank system. So you basically rank people into a group of A players who get a big bonus, B players who basically get to keep their jobs, and C players who get third prize, which is basically you're fired. Now, the interesting thing is this system has been tried many times before. GE started it in the 80s. And in many cases, it's actually failed. There's very little scientific evidence to show that it actually works very well. So it seems to be more about ideology, what people believe is right, rather than what actually pays off. What it does actually produce is sabotage. Workers tend to sabotage each other. And if you look at the New York Times piece on Amazon, it bears this out. It talks about how they would throw colleagues in the deep end of the pool to get their bonuses and so on.
Hmm. Esther, does this pay off at all?
Well, I think that one of the things that's striking to me is that a lot of these technologies have exploded precisely in the years since the financial crisis of 2008, when we've had one of the most slack labor markets on record in this country since the Great Depression, right? So these systems were created at a time when you could fire at will, you could make jobs intolerable to your employees and count on there being a long line of people at the door to replace them with. So that idea of retention being a value was just not present during the period that these systems have been so rapidly adopted. I think the question is, now that the labor market's tightening a little bit, is there going to begin to be a shift where retention actually becomes a bigger priority? And this is up and down the food chain. The just-in-time scheduling systems that Karen Levy was just talking about in retail and fast food, Starbucks, et cetera, that's based on the idea that there's an infinite supply of minimum wage workers out there. So you can make a job intolerable, you can make the hours inconsistent, you can make it impossible to have a second job or a or night school or a kid to take care of, or an elderly parent, because there's going to be another one knocking on the door for the job the next day. And then we saw that in the New York Times Amazon piece as well, that their whole style is churn. To me, that's a set of priorities that reflect the fact that employees' interests, concerns, well-being was just never factored in. Now, these algorithms are very sophisticated. Employee interests could be factored in. These systems could be modified to take into account the needs of workers. That just hasn't happened yet.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned this a little bit before, Karen, about the fall of unions and influence. If unions were stronger these days, would we have such abuse, do you think?
I mean, some of the recent lawsuits and recent kind of motions to try and reform just-in-time scheduling practices, things like that, have come from workers that are striving to unionize, particularly in fast food. So I think there's certainly some recognition that more labor power would help, right? Mm-hmm. They all boil down to just being straight economic issues, right, about livability and being able to get a fair wage. But I think there are some technical solutions, too, that can help to kind of reintroduce, as Esther was just saying, these algorithms and the companies that make them are very sophisticated. And some of them recently, actually, especially after some of the popular backlash in the press, have taken some steps to try and give managers better options to create more humane schedules, or give employees tools to like swap schedules between one another, mm-hmm. things like that. So I think there are probably some top-down regulatory solutions and some labor solutions, and maybe some things that the tech companies can do to try and help.
All right, we'll have to. This is a terrific storyline. We're going to continue this and continue following the story of technology. You know, and it does go way back to when we all talked about people losing their jobs because of robots and stuff like that. So Esther Kaplan is an editor at the Investigative Fund, a nonprofit reporting workshop in New York. Karen Levy is a fellow at the Data and Society Research Institute. And Andre Spicer is a professor of organizational behavior at the Cass Business School at City University of London in the UK. Thank you all for taking time to be with us today. Did you ever watch the TV show 30 Rock? Well, in one episode aptly named Sun Tea, the character Liz Lemon is grossed out by her coworker Frank Rositano, who she catches, well, keeping jars of a certain liquid in his office. But another character, Kenneth, steps in to show Liz what's become of those jars' contents.
Mr. Rositano has actually been emptying his jars out there.
He's been pouring them out the window? Oh, that is beautiful.
Yeah, what she sees below is a flower box bursting with flowers, fertilized in this case by Frank's pee. I always thought peeing on pansies would actually kill them. Don't we shoo dogs away from flower beds? But scientists have been investigating whether urine can be a viable fertilizer. And joining me now to discuss whether urine could be the new gold standard for fertilizers, sorry about that, is Krista Wingington. She's assistant professor of environmental engineering at the University of Michigan in Ann Arbor. She joins us from Michigan Radio. Welcome to Science Friday.
Hi, it's great to be here.
I always thought urine was bad for plants, to keep the dogs away, the brown spots on the lawn.
Well, I think if it's used correctly, it can be very good for plants. We just have to get the dose right.
Give us an idea of why urine should be helpful to growing plants.
Well, urine contains a lot of nitrogen and phosphorus and potassium. In fact, if you look at what we excrete, more than half of the nitrogen and phosphorus and potassium that we excrete comes out in our urine, and that tends to be what we add to plants to fertilize them. So we're interested in capturing those nutrients and turning it into a fertilizer product rather than sending it to the wastewater treatment plant where it's treated in different ways.
And how can we capture it? What's the best way to do that?
Well, there's toilets that are made specifically for source separation or urine diversion. That's what we call it. And this is becoming common in other parts of the world. It's still a fairly new idea in the United States. But there's definitely ways to capture the urine where the users of the toilet really aren't inconvenienced at all. It's just mm-hmm. like they're using a regular toilet.
Can it be as simple as just pouring it out onto the plants like on that TV show?
Well, we're definitely not we're not suggesting that. What we're interested in doing is collecting the urine and then turning it into a more controlled fertilizer. There's things in fertilizer that we probably don't want to be applying directly to plants and to the soil. Urine can contain pathogens and it can contain pharmaceuticals. So we're looking at how to remove those and turn it into a safe and practical fertilizer.
Now, you've been working with the Rich Earth Institute in Vermont. They have been collecting urine on a community-wide scale, correct?
That's right. Yeah, I think they're the first organization in the United States who's doing that at the community scale. And so we were funded by the EPA and the Water Environment Research Foundation. It's a large collaboration with the Rich Earth Institute, with the University of Buffalo, Hampton Roads Sanitation District in Virginia, and Brown and Caldwell Engineering. So it's a large project, and we're looking all the way from collect the practical aspects of collecting urine through treating it, turning it into a product, and then the Rich Earth Institute in Vermont has these farms where we actually apply the products and see how it does. We're growing carrots and lettuce. So that's, yeah, it's a large project and it's ongoing.
What do you have to do to treat it?
We're looking at different things. So there's two things you want to that you want to focus on. First is condensing it. So it's not very practical to truck large volumes of urine around. So it's better to concentrate the nutrients down to smaller volumes or even as precipitates. So concentrating it, that makes it cheaper and easier to move around. And then the other thing is we need to get rid of the pharmaceuticals and organisms that are in it. So we can pasteurize it by heating it up. That gets rid of the microorganisms. Precipitating out this crystal, mineral called struvite, that tends to get rid of the pharmaceuticals. But there's researchers who are doing things like ion exchange to pull off the nitrogen and phosphorus ions, using reverse osmosis to concentrate the nutrients. There's lots of different ways you can treat it, but it's all about concentrating and getting rid of some of the other constituents. Yeah.
If I wanted to try this at home, what should I do?
Oh, well, people are doing it at the household scale. So part of this research is trying to help the EPA come up with guidelines, maybe policies on what should be done with urine before it is applied to plants and to soils. So I don't think I'm in a position to tell people what to do at the household level, but it's being done, and there are lots of websites out there where people can get help on what they should do before they apply it to their yards.
I'm sure. I'm Ira Flatow. This is Science Friday for PRI, Public Radio International. Talking with Krista Wigington. I think we may have somebody on the phone or a caller to tell us what they're doing. Hi, Ivan in Cincinnati. Welcome to Science Friday.
Hi, thanks, Ivan, for taking my call. So just get really quick to it. I'm originally from California. I used to stay at my friend's house a lot, Pasadena, so shout out to KPCC. And because of the whole drought, he was really worried about, you know, all the waste when flushing just a regular house toilet from just urinating. So he started urinating outside, and he has a bunch of orange trees there. And one day, we got really brave, and we tried one, and they're huge, and they're just beautiful. And I swear to God, it was the best orange I've ever had.
There you go. Certainly for California, saving water. All right. Thanks for sharing. Do you have a comment, Carissa?
Yeah, I do. So I think that's one advantage to this urine separation is that right now the way we handle urine is we flush it down the toilet, and we do that with water that's been treated to a drinking water standard, and we flush a lot of water. So we flush several times a day, gallons of water every time. Most of those are for flushing urine down, and so especially in places like California where all of that water is so precious, it really doesn't make sense to be flushing so much down the drain.
Mm-hmm. It's kind of a waste of water in California at this moment. So do you think this will catch on, this whole idea? What's it going to take to scale it up?
Yeah, I think so. I definitely expect in the next 10 to 20 years people are going to hear more about this. The number one thing that's holding it up right now is infrastructure. I mean, we have a great sanitation system in the United States. But there's definitely some inefficiencies. The water is one of them. But to actually make this work at the society level in the United States, we'd have to rip up, you know, all of the sewer lines, install a separate line for urine all the way to the wastewater treatment plant. And if we wanted to do this in Detroit has 3,500 miles of sewage lines. So you can just imagine the scale that project would be, ripping up all of the ground and putting these, you know, urine-only pipes in. So I think infrastructure is what's holding us back. But definitely at maybe the building scale or at the household scale, I think we'll see more of this in the future. And we're already seeing some buildings. Our partners at HRSD in Virginia, they've taken their headquarters and put in source separating toilets, and they're collecting it in a tank outside for the research.
Is there any bacteria that could be harmful to plants or groundwater?
Yeah, there's bacteria that would be harmful if it came back into contact with humans. So I think some people think of urine as being sterile, but when you collect big batches of urine, people have urinary tract infections, and that can be bacterial or viral. And also, whenever you collect urine, you do tend to get some fecal contamination. So there's pathogens there, and that's why it needs to be sanitized.
Well, since give us something to think about this weekend.
That's right.
Yeah, and as you say, there are websites out there if you want to learn how to, you know, whiz in your garden, you know, so to speak. Well, the people out there to help you. Thank you very much for taking time to be with us today, Krista.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
Krista Wigington is Assistant Professor of Environmental Engineering at the University of Michigan in Ann Arbor. One last thing. Back in the 1980s, I was taping a segment of a TV show I used to do called Newton's Apple, and the director unexpectedly stopped the taping and couldn't understand why. It was going so very well. Then Jimmy Carter walked out onto the set. He extended his hand and said, "I was in town, just wanted to say hello." We shook hands, chatted for a few seconds, and then he left as quietly as he came. Our paths had crossed briefly in my work covering Three Mile Island and during his prescient calls in the White House for renewable energy. I have not met President Carter again, but as I watched his news conference yesterday announcing the spread of his cancer, I was reminded of his warmth, his intelligence, and eternal optimism. He was one of the most general and smartest politicians I've ever met without actually training in nuclear engineering. He actually had a training in nuclear engineering, and I wish, of course, him all the best in the coming months. Charles Berkowitz is our director. Our senior producer is Christopher Intagliata. Alexa Lim is our associate producer. Our SciArts producer is Annie Minoff. Luke Raskin is our video producer. Our production assistant is Becky Fogel. Rich Kim is our technical director. Sarah Fishman, our engineer, at the controls here at the studios of our production partners, the City University of New York. And to all our Sci-Fi Book Club members out there, we're going to talk like a computer. We want you to talk like one. Our latest education activity is going to teach you how to write your name in binary. I like that. Try it yourself at sciencefriday.com/binary. And you'll learn how to do that. And if you'd like to write us, please, not in binary, send your letters to Science Friday, 19 West 44th Street, room 412, New York, New York, 10036. In New York, I'm Ira Flatow. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. I was in Northern California this week and experienced my first West Coast earthquake. It was a magnitude 4. But how strong is a 4? What does that mean, anyhow? As an earthquake newbie, I wasn't quite sure, but it appears I am not alone. Sarah Zhang, a science writer for Wired, calls the Bay Area her home, so she's no stranger to earthquakes. But after her apartment got rattled by that one on Monday, even she began wondering just how useful the numbers are.
So I've caught myself thinking, you know, how much worse can a 6 be than a 4? And when I look at the numbers, like 4 and 6, seems like, can't be that bad, right?
And that earthquake happened just a day after Zhang wrote the article, "The way we measure earthquakes is stupid." She spoke with Lucy Jones, a seismologist with the U.S. Geological Survey. She's also concerned that the public doesn't get earthquake magnitude. And now Dr. Jones joins us from KPCC in Pasadena to continue our discussion. Welcome to Science Friday.
Oh, I'm glad to be here.
In 2000, you wrote, "I hate the Richter scale."
Right. And I had to say, this is a hard thing for a seismologist to say, but I'm often in the position of trying to explain it to people, and it's not easy to explain. It's not a very intuitive process. It's also arbitrary and empirical, which bothers me as a scientist.
Wasn't it given up in the 70s, the Richter scale?
No. All right. So the Richter scale as the definition exactly like Richter defined it, we gave up in the 90s, as really because of computerization. What Richter did, you know, was how do you try and measure the total size of an earthquake off of a piece of paper? And there's a really limit to the dynamic range on a piece of paper, and you've got to only look at certain frequencies, et cetera. With now digital seismographs, we have so many more options open to us. We have much more accurate ways of trying to estimate the size. So we gave up his technique, but we have kept the concept, magnitude as an arbitrary empirical definition of the total size of an earthquake. It's not a definition of what you feel. He developed it back in the 20s to try and get people off of the idea that what they felt would tell them how big the earthquake was. And he's saying, really, there's a size to the earthquake that's not what you feel. It's how much energy is released in the earth. And what you feel is a combination of that with how far away you are and what soils you were in. Lots of other factors play into what you feel.
Sort of sounds like your hearing. Your hearing doesn't exactly measure how loud a sound is. It's just how you perceive the sound.
Right. There's an intensity of the sound in your ear, the decibels that you receive. That's not how much energy was released by, you know, the airplane. If you were right next to the airplane, it's much louder than if you're farther away. Right? And seismic waves are just waves. They're exactly like sound waves. And, you know, but with an airplane, you might want to know how big the engine is. With an earthquake, we want to know how much, you know, what happened in the earth. So as seismologists, you know, we need that concept of how big is the event, but then when we use it to describe it to people, we're getting a lot of confusion. In Japan, where, of course, they have quite a few more earthquakes than we do here in California, they determine magnitude, but that's not what they release to the public. They release the intensity. What did it feel like to you? How strong was the shaking? And there's the maximum intensity, the worst that anybody got, and then the intensity at your site. And many people think that's what magnitude is. I'll often get the question, well, if it's a magnitude 8 on the San Andreas, what will it be in LA? Well, it's still a magnitude 8. That's the size of the earthquake. But the shaking is intensity 10 in the desert and intensity 8 in the city or something like that. So I like the idea of using intensity as a way to communicate with people.
Yeah, because people also confuse a magnitude 5 with a 6, and they think, oh, 6 is just one more than a 5, when it's actually the shaking's a lot stronger.
Well, then right.
It's not linear.
And it's not even logarithmic, right? Richter originally defined it as the logarithm of the ground velocity. So sort of the single biggest swing on a seismograph. But a bigger earthquake releases energy over a longer time and over a bigger area. So the energy released actually goes up faster than just the logarithm. And each unit of magnitude actually represents a factor of 32 in the total energy released. And sort of the other big thing that's changed in, you know, 90 years of recording earthquakes, now that we do them on seismograms and we've done a lot of research, a guy named Professor Keiichi Aki determined something called, or created a quantity called the seismic moment, which is also representing the total size in the earthquake, but is now a physical quantity with units that you can measure, and you can compare it to what happens in the geology with what happens on the seismograph. And it's a much more accurate way of representing that total size. And since we can now do it easily because of computers, you know, back when Aki first did this, it took months to get your moment calculated. Now we can do it in minutes. We actually use that as our primary measure of the earthquake, and then we create an equivalent magnitude, believing that the public still understands magnitude and still wants to get that information. And I think we're misinterpreting how much people understand, and we'd be much better off talking about actual seismic moment and helping people understand that big scaling effect.
When you say the seismic moment, okay, tell us what we should listen for and how we might better understand it.
Okay. The problem is if the units are complicated, and, you know, so the Northridge earthquake was 1.2 times 10 to the 19th Newton meters. I actually tried to describe that in a sound bite, and it doesn't work, right? So what we proposed back in 2000 was, let's create a unit and Professor Aki did this great work. Let's name it after him and have it be an Aki. So if we define it as 10 to the 15th Newton meters, we can say, you know, that magnitude 5 is about one Aki. That 4 that you just felt would be about 30 milliAkis. The biggest earthquake that ever is recorded is in the teraAkis. And the smallest one we look at are microAkis or even smaller than that. And then you start, you know, now people know those terms because of computers, right? Yeah. We have kilobyte and megabyte and gigabyte. People know what that means now. And it will help people see that, in fact, a magnitude 4 and a magnitude 6, you're talking about 30 milliAkis versus 30 Akis. It's 1,000 times bigger.
Huh. So is that what those magnitudes are? They're measured in Akis?
Well, we haven't yet gotten it officially accepted as a formal. We still say Newton meters, and that's complicated for people.
I think so.
So, yeah, I'm hoping that we can get this through. We're actually putting a proposal together of how to. There's an official process by which you define units. There's a commission that maintains the metric system, and we're proposing the Aki as a unit. And then we could use it and start saying these, more intuitive ways of understanding the energy in an earthquake.
And what does an earthquake mean to a scientist? You're trying to get this so that the public understands it, but what use is it to scientists, earthquakes? Different than what the public generally thinks.
Well, right. I mean, there's a couple of things to... We see earthquakes often as tools for understanding the Earth. So when an earthquake happens, it releases waves and they travel through the Earth. And just like we can use a CAT scan, we're basically doing a CAT scan of the Earth using the earthquake waves. They also tell us how the mountains are being made. When I see an earthquake, the 4 on the Hayward Fault last week in San Francisco, that's actually showing us how San Francisco Bay is being created and opened up as different pieces of the crust move around. And then there's also sort of that fundamental physics question, why do we have an earthquake? Why do we have an earthquake today and not tomorrow? What's the strength of the rock? What makes it break? All of those are pretty interesting scientific questions, which is what the scientists are really focused on. So we use moment. We often use magnitude as an easier to say. Magnitude 3 is easier than rattling off the moment.
So what are the main factors that you take into account when you determine its power and its impact? Is it what the Earth is made out of, where it is, or what are the factors going on the ground that say, oh, this is a big one, this is a smaller one?
Actually, all of those things, but the most important thing is the area of the fault that moves in an earthquake. An earthquake actually is a lot like snapping your fingers. When you snap your fingers, you have two surfaces in frictional contact. Because you're pushing them together, there's friction that keeps them moving sideways. You push hard enough to overcome that friction, and it moves suddenly, releasing energy in the form of a sound wave. If you didn't push your fingers together, they would slide past each other without making a noise, which shows you that if the fault could open up, you wouldn't have an earthquake. You can't have an earthquake if the fault opens up because there's no friction. Right? So, but you also can't snap your fingers at a point. You need a surface. And the same thing with an earthquake. They do not happen at epicenters. They happen over a surface, one side moving past the other. And the area of that surface times the amount that one side slips past the other, and then, in fact, times the rigidity of the rock, how much the rock is resisting being moved. That's what we define as the seismic moment. And the cool part about that is you can do that with geology. You can go out and measure the length of the fault and estimate the width and get how much one side slipped and compare that to what we do with the seismographs, and we're getting the same answer. So it means that we can correlate what happens on a modern seismograph with what happened historically. That's how we can tell you that the 1906 earthquake in San Francisco was a magnitude 7.8.
Well, I love that finger analogy because it works when you look at it and think about how you press harder and it makes a bigger snap.
Right. Well, and the other part about it is, think about it. when a seismologist talks about an earthquake, we talk about the movement of a fault. We're talking about one finger moving past the other. But when just about anybody else talks about an earthquake, they're talking about what they felt. So they're talking about the sound that was created. And right there, there's a fundamental disconnect that I've seen many times lead to confusion, because the seismologists tend to be talking about a different thing than most people are.
Well, Lucy, I thank you for talking about it, because I think you cleared up a lot of what we don't understand.
Well, great. That's wonderful.
Lucy Jones is a seismologist with the U.S. Geological Survey based in Los Angeles, California. We're going to take a break, and then we're going to come back. We're going to talk about how a technologist and an artist team up to make artwork as big as Los Angeles. Big. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. Now, the story of an art museum that's taken on the role of matchmaker. The Los Angeles County Museum of Art has been pairing up artists and technologists to see what new art the two groups can make together. Science Friday's SciArts producer Annie Minoff headed to L.A. to check out one of these new art projects, and she joins me now to talk about it. Welcome.
Thank you, Ira.
So, Annie, why would an art museum get into the matchmaking business? Why pair up an artist and technologist?
Well, Amy Heibel runs this program, Art and Technology, out of the Los Angeles County Museum of Art. And she says, really, the museum just sees this as one more way that they can be of service to artists. So you have a lot of artists who have very big ideas about how they want to use tech in their work, but maybe they don't have the tech know-how, or maybe they don't have the access to tools that you have at, say, you know, a Google or a SpaceX. And so what the museum can do is really bring together these two players and kind of create a sandbox where artists and technologists can play around and experiment.
And so how do you decide which artist to pair up with what tech company?
Yeah, it's kind of voodoo, right? Because they really have to get along. So the museum has actually taken a cue from the dating world. And what they do is they invite the artists and the technologists down to the museum, and everyone talks with everyone else for about 15 minutes, and it kind of looks like a speed dating session. So here's LACMA's Amy Heibel.
We're not making an arranged marriage. We're creating an environment where they can meet each other, and we're letting natural connections emerge, and then we're encouraging those.
So one of the pairings that emerged from one of these speed dating sessions was between the artist John Craig Freeman and a tech CEO named Brian Mullins. And so a few months ago, I flew out to LA to kind of see the artwork that these two had created. And it took me to a really interesting corner of downtown LA called Pershing Square. Downtown LA's Pershing Square doesn't look like much. It's a park built on top of an underground parking garage. There's grass, a few trees and planters, and a lot of high concrete barriers. Artist John Craig Freeman knows the park doesn't get a lot of love from Angelenos.
The residents have told me that they're ambivalent about it. Sometimes it could be an intimidating space and be a little scary even.
But today, he's out to show me and a handful of art fans another side of the square. He's created an artwork here, but to see it, we need to download a smartphone app called Layer.
And we see it right there, Layer.
As it boots up, Layer turns on my iPhone's camera.
And so if you hold your phone up now, it might take a while to start downloading assets.
But what is that? Really... I'm looking at my cell phone screen, and suddenly, there on the grass, is this guy. He's got a kind of pixely look about him. And behind him is a very large, very dead bird.
Oh, there he is. You see that?
Yeah.
Doesn't it look like a dead chicken?
Tourist John Watovich has his phone out, too. He says the dead bird isn't the first weird thing he's seen floating around Pershing Square.
The backpack was cool. It really was. It was huge, and it came at me.
Yes, there is a giant floating backpack. There's also a little red wagon and a beat-up fire call box. Walking through Pershing Square, I feel like I've wandered into a surrealist painting. But Craig says there's meaning behind all this madness.
So for the past couple of months, we've been going out in the city of Los Angeles and encountering people more or less at random. And we asked them what they've lost and videotaped their response.
Okay, so Matt, I'm going to just ask you a single question. Just take as much time as you need. What have you lost?
That pixely guy on the grass is Matt. Craig met him passing through Pershing Square last March. And Matt answered Craig's what have you lost question like this.
I've lost my faith in humanity.
In Craig's hands...
That's represented by a dead bird at his feet. Another person told us that they've lost their childhood, and that's represented by a red wagon just over there.
The bird, the wagon, the backpack, they all represent things people told Craig that they'd lost. Craig recreated them digitally and placed them back here in the park for us to find. There's a name for this magic trick. Augmented reality.
Augmented reality's been around for a while, but it was just about 2010 that it became easily accessible for individuals just using common cell phones.
You've probably heard of virtual reality. You put on a headset and suddenly the outside world is gone and instead there's this completely digital environment. Well, augmented reality is a little bit different. It doesn't block out capital R reality. Looking through my phone, I can still see grass, trees, the ugly concrete barriers of Pershing Square. But I'm also seeing this extra stuff that Craig's put here. Augmented reality is a digital bird lying in analog grass. Craig's been using it for art, but technology companies are pretty excited about it too, for different reasons.
Let's say someone is a field force engineer fixing a gas turbine on a jet airplane. When they look at that engine, they can actually see, as if it were special effects from a movie, but laid out in the real world, how to fix that.
That's Brian Mullins. Brian's the CEO of an augmented reality company called Daqri. And he's betting that augmented reality is going to transform how industrial workers do their jobs. In Daqri's vision of the future, engineers look at machine specs that appear right on top of the machines they're trying to fix. Brian met Craig at a meet and greet hosted by LACMA's Art and Technology program. And according to Brian, it was a meeting of the geek minds.
In just a few minutes of talking, we realized we shared so many passions.
Passion for augmented reality, for reading brainwaves.
We were kind of kindred spirits in a way.
And then Craig the artist asked Brian the technologist a pretty out there question. Could you be thinking about something you'd lost, like your keys, and then have those keys appear in front of you in augmented reality? Could you think a lost object back into being? The short answer, according to Brian, was no. But together, they started tinkering with a workaround, a way to conjure up lost objects with just your thoughts. After our digital scavenger hunt, I meet Craig, the artist at LACMA. Just like at the park, he has his iPad in front of him, though he has a different name for it.
I'm standing in front of the augmented reality viewing device.
What's different this time is this thick black rubber band that Craig has circling his head. This is an electroencephalogram headset, courtesy of Brian. And on the inside band are these tiny sensors measuring Craig's brain waves.
And now I'm going to think deeply about what it is I've lost.
It takes a second, but then with that buzz, a lost object suddenly appears on Craig's iPad.
So this is the lost print media. It's an old newspaper stand.
The newsstand looks like it's planted in the middle of the museum floor. Now, were you thinking of what you'd lost when you recalled that?
Yeah, I wasn't thinking about the newsstand particularly. When that question's asked back to me, it's my response is lost home.
Craig was thinking about lost home. What he got was a newsstand. That's because that EEG headset he's wearing, it can't read thoughts. What it can do is look for patterns in Craig's brainwaves that suggest that Craig is really thinking hard about something, that he's really focusing. And when it picks up on that signal, a random lost object appears. This time?
Now we're looking at an old telephone booth for lost payphones.
It is possible to think a digital object into being. You just can't be too picky about which one. And that doesn't bother Craig. He says, we're just beginning to learn what augmented reality can do.
It's a pretty powerful experience, being able to use brainwave sensing as an interface for generating a virtual reality. I think that that's a question to start with, not one to end with.
This summer, LACMA will bring two new groups of artists and technologists together. It'll be the beginning of a whole new experiment. And who can say ahead of time what new kinds of art might materialize? For Science Friday, I'm Annie Minoff.
Great tour, Annie. Thank you for taking us on that. Can you still see those lost objects out in Pershing Square?
Absolutely. The great thing about creating your artwork in augmented reality is no one ever tells you to take your installation down. So absolutely, they're still there. If you live in the Los Angeles area, we have instructions that'll help you find those lost things at sciencefriday.com/art and tech.
Can you get the app? Can we get the app and look at this?
Yeah, it's yourself? Called Layer. Yeah. Download it.
Download it and go looking.
Go looking. That's right.
Mm-hmm.
Now, this the interesting part about this story, an interesting aspect is that this is not actually the first time that the Los Angeles County Museum of Art has paired artists and technologists. In fact, the first time they did this was all the way back in 1967. And that program only lasted for about 4 years. But in that time, it actually included the big names in 20th century art. So Andy Warhol, Klaus Oldenburg, John Chamberlain, if you've ever gone to an art museum and
seen
the crushed up car sculptures, it's the A-list. And so all of them were alums of this first, 1967 art and technology program. And so to talk more about that, I want to bring on Patrick McCray. He's a professor of history at UC Santa Barbara, and he's actually writing a book about art and technology collaborations. Welcome, Patrick.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Absolutely. So how did this original art and technology program get started all the way back in 1967?
The idea for the original program was the brainchild of a curator at LACMA named Maurice Tuckman. He had recently arrived at the museum, and he was eager to put Los Angeles on the cultural map. And he was from New York City, but he was interested in this idea of California as a place of the future. And he was very eager to partner artists with local California industries in the hopes that they would interact with engineers and scientists where they could get access to cutting-edge technology of the time, like lasers and video cameras and that sort of thing.
You know, back in the 60s, today you don't think that L.A. is the center of high technology companies, but there were a few around then.
It's really interesting because today we think of L.A. as a city that's primarily oriented around the entertainment industry, but it's important to remember that in the 1960s, Los Angeles was a city that was really based around aerospace and other high-tech, oftentimes defense-related industries that were very much the mainstay of the local economy.
So sort of like IBM, so things, people like that.
Companies like Lockheed and IBM and Hewlett-Packard, and then a whole array of companies that either don't exist today or have been merged or bought out by other larger entities.
Mm-hmm. And what about the artists? I know I mentioned a few of the big names, but who else was involved in this?
Yeah, you mentioned some of the big names that were involved, and the program really attracted stars from the New York City avant-garde art scene, people like Andy Warhol that you mentioned and Robert Rauschenberg. But it also brought in some younger up-and-coming artists, some of them from the East Coast, but also some from Los Angeles who were experimenting with new technologies. So one of the artists that I find really interesting is a man by the name of Rockne Krebs, who was from Washington, D.C., actually, who did a lot of work at the time with lasers to create sort of sculptures in space using laser light, which at the time was a very cutting-edge sort of thing to do.
Yeah, we don't usually think about lasers today being kind of the cutting edge, but back then...
They were invented in the early 60s, so people were very interested in them, and all they could do in those days is cut things.
Exactly. I mean, today we think of something like the laser pointer, which you can go on Amazon and buy for a few dollars and use it to amuse your cat. But in the 1960s, this was the sort of the realm of high tech, and lasers and other things like this were very big and very expensive, and they required teams of engineers and scientists to make them work, which is one of the reasons why partnering artists with technologists was a central part of the LACMA program.
And I mean, how close were these worlds of art and tech back in 1967? I mean, were collaborations like this a common thing?
They weren't that common, but although in the 1960s, there was this real boom in trying to foster art and science and art and technology collaborations. But the worlds of art and engineering were much more separate than they are today. Oftentimes, companies didn't know what to do with the artists, and there was oftentimes this sense that the artist was, a crazy person with weird hair who dressed funny, and the idea of pairing them with straight-laced middle management types or engineering types oftentimes created some tensions and ruffled some feathers as there were these attempts to bring these two different cultures together.
This is Science Friday from PRI Public Radio International. I'm Ira Flato here with Annie Minoff. We're talking with Patrick McCray.
So Patrick, tell us about a collaboration that really worked.
One of my favorite collaborations involved an American artist by the name of Robert Whitman, who was known in the 1960s for his installations that combined visual images and sound, sort of today what we would think of as multimedia environments. And he was partnered through the LACMA program with a physicist by the name of John Forkner. Forkner had grown up in the Philadelphia area and had been trained at Drexel University, but he migrated out to California and began to work with a defense contracting firm in the Newport Beach area. And through the LACMA project, they created this installation piece, which essentially filled an entire room. They created specially designed mirrors to generate a series of optical effects. One of the most striking was to take common objects like a clock or a goldfish in a goldfish bowl and to use optics to create a sense that these objects were floating in space in a sort of this ghost-like ethereal way in a darkened room. And this collaboration had a really big impact on both of their careers. This partnership continued until John Faulkner passed away in 2004, and Whitman really came to think of this engineer as an equal partner in creating art. And for the engineer Faulkner, this was a very transformational moment in his life. As he told one art critic, it really expanded his aesthetic horizons as an engineer. And I think it also offered a way for this engineer who worked at a company that basically made weapon systems to humanize technology, maybe offering him an escape mechanism of sorts from his 9-to-5 job.
Speaking of art critics, how did they or how well was this stuff received by them?
That's a great question. The critics' views, frankly, were largely negative. The industries that were involved with the LACMA program tended to be large corporate entities, and they are oftentimes connected with the war in Vietnam. And art critics oftentimes went after these art and engineering collaborations as a way to criticize industry and American society in general. And another aspect of it that became very controversial, less so when the program started in 1966, but by the time all these works were exhibited at LACMA in 1971, all the artists involved were white men. There were no women, there were no people of color involved, and this became a very controversial issue that the LACMA folks had to deal with as they were getting this exhibit underway.
And we should mention, too, that some of these collaborations just straight up failed, right?
Many of them straight up failed. One of the most interesting failures, if you will, involved a American sculptor by the name of John Chamberlain. And in the 1960s, he decided to experiment with some conceptual art practices instead of his usual sculpture work. And LACMA, after considerable effort, partnered him with an entity called RAND. RAND, short for Research and Development, was the preeminent think tank of the Cold War. It was started in 1946, and it was famous for developing scenarios for fighting thermonuclear war. It's lampooned in Stanley Kubrick's Dr. Strangelove, for example. So Chamberlain shows up at RAND, which is located in Santa Monica. It was a very straight-laced sort of place. And Chamberlain starts by showing one of his experimental films in the RAND cafeteria at lunchtime. And many of the employees found it disturbing, if not outright pornographic. So Chamberlain switches gears, and he decided that he wanted to interact with the RAND scientist and see what they were thinking about. So he circulates a memo to all of the employees there that said, basically, "I'm searching for answers, not questions." And he waited to see what responses they sent back. And the responses were very negative. Most of them were variations on calling him a pervert or questioning the value of having an artist in residence. But to them, an artist was simply someone who made things or painted.
Right.
And it was sort of a sign of this sort of mutual hostility between the art and the science world at that time.
Fascinating history. Patrick McRae is professor of history at University of California, Santa Barbara. Annie Minhoff, our Sci-Arts producer. Thanks for taking time to be with us today. We're going to take a break and talk about a new play by playwright Deborah Zarloffer. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. As genetic testing becomes more widespread, we have to answer new questions, like how much do we really want to know about our family history or our predisposition to disease? Back in the early 90s, members of the Arizona Havasupai tribe didn't get the chance to answer those questions for themselves. Instead, they were answered for them by researchers at Arizona State University. ASU geneticists collected blood from the Havasupai, hoping to unlock the secret of the tribe's high rate of diabetes. What the tribe members didn't know is that those researchers were also looking for other kinds of information having to do with mental health and their tribe's origins. The court battle that followed transformed medical ethics. It also inspired a new play by one of my favorite playwrights, Deborah Zarloffer. It's called Informed Consent, and it's just opened off Broadway to rave reviews. Deborah joins me here in our New York studios. Welcome back.
Thank you. I'm delighted to be here.
I love the play.
Oh, thanks, Ira.
You know, when you were back, You were back in here in our studios in 2009, and I asked, what are you going to be doing next? And you say, I think I'm going to write a play about the genome.
Right.
And you did.
I'm a little slow, but I made it back.
What is it about the genome that captured you?
I guess I'm just interested in whatever the latest breakthroughs are, and genomic research is just moving forward exponentially, and so it raises new questions that we've never had to answer before. Our parents never had to decide what they wanted to know about their body structure, about their future, about their mm-hmm. past, and also what they want to know about their children and how much they want to know before they have children.
Right. You know, it's interesting because we talk about this new issue, that you knock around and deal with very interestingly in the play is how much do you have a right not to know?
Right.
You know, and that's exactly what the theme of the play is.
It is. And I didn't realize when I read this article and decided to write a play about it, what a landmark case it wound up being. Because before that, informed consent had a lot more to do with physical harm, like Tuskegee or other studies where actual physical harm was done. But this is really psychological and emotional harm that was done with this study.
Can you give us a thumbnail of what the play's about?
Yeah. Well, the tribe's creation story is that they spring forth from the Grand Canyon, and they believe their blood is sacred. They've never given it for any other kind of research, but their rate of diabetes is so dire. It's 50% of the tribe, and there's less than 700 of them left. So they were in such a terrible situation that they were forced to turn for medical help. And what the researcher found was that the tribe originated in Eastern Asia, and so that contradicted their creation story. And that's what fascinates me, where science and religion sort of rub up against each other uncomfortably.
Mm. How did you find it? I mean, you said you were going to go write a play about genome. How did you stumble or look for this one?
Well, it's another Alfred P. Sloan Foundation play, and I had 4 days to get in a proposal. So
a whole 4 days?
Yeah, so naturally I went on Facebook, and I said, friends, send me articles. And I have a really good friend, Ben Stanger, who's at UPenn. He's a scientist and has his own lab there. And he sent me this article, and I knew immediately that was what I'd want to write about. I wrote the proposal the next day and then had to write the play.
Well, your plays now seem to be focusing on the tension between science and faith. I mean, your last play was also about science and faith, right?
It was the last play that brought me here. I've written probably 4 plays since then. Yeah. But
wait, that play was End Days.
Right.
Yeah. That was a terrific play.
Thank you.
I love that one also. But that was also a question of faith. Where does faith and science intersect, and where does one begin, one end? Are they both legitimate in your own mind? That sort of thing.
Right. Well, we're all just trying to figure out how to make it through the day, how to deal with our own mortality and why we're here. And so I'm just fascinated by what people choose to believe in order to answer the big questions for themselves. And science, for me, answers those questions or asks more questions. It's where I go to sort of find wonder and awe. And but I would never want anyone who has a belief in the afterlife or any sort of higher power to have that taken away, because you know that's a source of great comfort too. So I'd love to write about a place where both points of view can be respected. But there's always tremendous tension and push and pull there.
Mm-hmm. You created, tell us about Jillian, the genetic anthropologist, and Arella, the leader of the Havasupai tribe.
Yeah. Well, Jillian is, I saw a number of TED Talks where there were scientists who might be considered a little bit fringe or maybe even crackpot, who think that we're very close to finding a way to be immortal, and that if we all just give our genomic material, that research will speed along so quickly that we'll find a way to become immortal. Our children's children will become immortal. And I thought, what if I have a character like that, and who's also in a race against time, because she knows her own genetic history and her genetic futures that she has early onset Alzheimer's. And so I wanted a character who was so driven that she would really go to any lengths, and it's to save her daughter. And then the spokesperson I have from the tribe, Arella, you know, her mother died of diabetes, and she's also worried about her daughter. So it's very much about mothers and daughters and what we pass on to the next generation.
Yeah, because there's the same conflict in her mind about her daughter as right. the tribe about learning what they would learn.
Exactly. And one of the things I learned, and I went down and spent a night with the tribe. The Sloan Foundation sent me down there. And one of the things I discovered is what was most devastating to them is having their story taken away from them, their creation story and their identity and who they are. And that really cracked open something for me in the play, because Alzheimer's, my main character, Jillian, is losing her story and her identity. So I thought the parallel there would really create another level to the play.
So where does the fiction come in? How does your story depart from the real court case?
Both characters I have fictionalized. My grandmother died of Alzheimer's at something. My teacher, Marcia Norman, had said, you know, when you're at a loss, write about the thing that terrifies you most. And
take a role model, Marcia Norman.
Oh, she's amazing. Yeah. But anyway, so in my family, that's Alzheimer's since my grandmother died of it. So I knew genetically that would be something that really was frightening for me to explore and also exciting to delve deeper into for a character. So that was not the case with the actual scientist. She wasn't mm-hmm. studying Alzheimer's. She was studying schizophrenia. So I departed in that way.
It's a little, yeah. You're allowed to.
Thank you.
You're not doing a documentary.
Thank
That's
you.
What the theater is all about, right? Well, you know, we learn new things about the genome every day. What looks like junk DNA today could tell us a lot 5 years from now.
Right.
Is there really such thing as truly informed consent when it comes to DNA?
That's a great question. And it's one of the questions I pose in the play. And I think what the takeaway is that you can't fully represent what could be looked for in a DNA sample. But if you want to keep looking further, what you need to do is come back and get permission. You have to ask for informed consent. So it's not just a piece of paper. It's a living document and a living contract between people.
Mm-hmm. But what the play has done, it has given a vehicle for medical students, med students to discuss this, because this is something they have to confront. Are they using this play?
It's been such a thrill for me, because med schools all around the country are asking to teach the play. And it was done in Cleveland at the Cleveland Playhouse and also at Jiva Theater in Rochester. And when it was done in Cleveland, Case Western was teaching it in their medical ethics classes. And so this was the case that they were studying, which was just by luck. I didn't know that when I went there. Hmm. And so they were studying six different documents over the course of the semester, and the sixth was mine. The others were all medical and legal documents. And so I got to go in and be part of the class and listen to discussions, in the response mm-hmm. to the play. And I think they discovered the same thing I sort of discovered when I went down and met the tribe, is that it's all very well and good to understand what informed consent is in an intellectual way, but when you put a face on it and understand the actual personal implications, it really changes the way you think about it.
Yeah. In case you just joined us, I'm talking with Deborah Zoloffer, author, playwright of Informed Consent, that's just opened off Broadway. How long a run do you have?
Just till September 13th.
Oh.
Yeah.
Any chance of getting extended?
Well, there's another play by Topher Payne coming in soon after, so I don't think we could extend very long, but maybe a little.
When you started thinking about the character here, did you have a piece of yourself in that? You talked about, was it your grandmother with Alzheimer's?
Yeah, there's a lot of me in the play. People who know me well come and say, wow, there's a lot of you in the play. And the main character is not a lovable character necessarily. She's pretty prickly. Which
she's obnoxious, all of them.
She's kind of obnoxious, yeah. And I love that about her. There aren't that many female characters in dramatic literature mm-hmm. who are allowed to be obnoxious and pushy and desperate and angry and think they're the smartest person in the room, which is what she is. That's what she thinks. And so That was one of the things I really wanted to create, is a female protagonist who's that strong.
Well, part of that is whether she wants to be tested or not, mm-hmm. about having the disease. Did that change your mind about yourself?
Well, it's something my mother and I have talked about after my grandmother had Alzheimer's. And it was amazing to me because I think we had both sort of thought, well, someday. But after seeing the play, my mom is getting tested. She's actually done tests and hasn't gotten results back yet. But I was surprised. And people who've come to see the play, we've had couples come see it who thought they knew where they stood on getting their children tested or getting tested mm-hmm. themselves. And then they have arguments after the play. And so if I can make people argue with each other, I feel like I've done a good thing.
That's what it's all about. I'm Ira Flatow. This is Science Friday from PRI, Public Radio International. Talking with a playwright, Deborah Zoloffer, about informed consent, a terrific play. It does make you walk away discussing it, even with strangers. Everybody's talking about it. And there's a scene in the play where Jillian, the scientist, seems to be giving a TED talk. Mm-hmm. She's making some fantastical claims. Was that a little bit of a dig at TED Talks?
It's not. I love TED Talks. I could listen to them all day, really, online. So it's not. I'm fascinated by them. And so people have asked me that. I guess I can never get tired of them.
Yeah.
So putting them on stage was fun for me.
Mm-hmm. You visited the Havasupai Village at the bottom of the Grand Canyon. That must have been one heck of an experience.
It was incredible. It was an incredible experience. The tribe had 7 million acres was theirs, and they've been cut down to a few thousand acres. And even though that seems like a lot of land that they could still farm or have cattle, their water access was cut off when they first were cut down. And so, you know, during dry times, the crops would die and the cattle would die. So the circumstances are pretty dire. All their food, for the most part, has to be shipped in. And it's like government cheese, big blocks of cheese and white bread and Doritos. So there's not
very healthy stuff.
Yeah, and it was when I was there, it was almost 120 degrees. So it's not like you could ship in any greens or fruit and have it, you know, keep. Yeah. So it's a pretty desperate situation there. And
yeah, did it affect how you wrote the play? I mean,
it did.
Yeah?
It really
in what way?
Yeah, those specifics really changed. And I added a couple scenes for Arella after that. I felt like she needed as much weight in the play as Jillian does.
Hmm. Did you have your own moments of cultural miscommunication about what the tribe was really like, what life was like?
I did. And I've found myself stumbling along clumsily, just as my main character does in writing this play, making all sorts of assumptions and thinking I'm being culturally sensitive. But for one thing, in the New York Times, the article, there's a video showing the tribe collecting their blood. And in that video, they're singing a tribal song and going through some, mm-hmm. a ritual in collecting it. And I wanted to be very true to them and have that exact same song on stage, and I couldn't find it anywhere. And I asked a member of another tribe. I was very lucky to have members of the Seneca tribe mm-hmm. Helping me when I was getting the play first done in Rochester. And one of the members of the tribe said, "Oh, don't use that song. They would never want you to use the actual song on stage." And I said, "Well, what can I use?" And they said, "Well, make up a song, something, just make up words and make up a tune that's similar." And I thought, well, I'm Jewish. If I were going to use, something that sounded sort of Yiddishy, right, I would be in big trouble. But that was making a big leap. I just made a lot of assumptions about what would be okay.
I think a little bit of the Yiddishy sneaked in there. It felt a little bit like I was listening to something like... So you're already working on another science play, I understand.
I am.
You're hooked. That's
good. I am definitely... Well, I just want to keep coming back to talk to you, Ira.
Well, it's our pleasure. What's this one going to be about?
It's about neurology. I'm interested in learning more about the brain. And so it's going to be, there's... we've known for since Dostoevsky and before, that a part of the brain that's affected by epilepsy or a tumor, and people have ecstatic religious experiences. And so I'm gonna have that happen to my main character in my new play.
I understand it's a comedy?
Yes.
A comedy about a brain tumor.
Yes, I'm dying for a comedy. We'll see how it goes. You'll tell me.
I want to know who's going to play the lead. We'll have you back.
Good.
Thanks, Deborah. It's a wonderful play. It's Informed Consent. It's playing at the Duke Theater here in Manhattan through September 13th. Who knows? Maybe it'll get extended. It's going to go around the country?
Well, there's already people asking to do it.
Oh, that's terrific. Deborah, thank you very much.
Thank you so much.
Taking time to be with us today. B.J. Lederman composed our theme music. Our thanks to our production partners at the studios of the City University of New York. And this week, a plant known as the corpse flower stunk up the Denver Botanic Garden with a rotten stench. You can guess what it smells like from the name, but the flower itself is a compelling sight to behold. And it's our picture of the week. And you can see it at sciencefriday.com. Corpse flower. It's a very unusual and unique sight and smell. Have a great weekend. We'll see you next week. I'm Ira Flatow in New York.